You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Nationals reporter, Jamal Collier. Jamal, the winter meetings are over, and the Nationals did get busy late in the winter meetings. It took a while as different deals kind of fell through and didn't get done, but at the end of the day, on last Wednesday, they go ahead and they do trade Adam Eaton. There was criticism for the deal from some as far as what they gave up. But Eaton certainly fills a need for this team as far as an outfielder goes. Trey Turner will move back into the infield. We'll get on a little with that a little bit later in the podcast as far as Danny Espinosa goes. But as we are about a week since that deal of Adam Eaton, now that the dust has kind of settled, what's the feeling around the organization about what this guy's going to bring to the Nationals?
Yeah, Tim, it certainly surprised a lot of people around baseball when you kind of saw the names and just the level of prospects that were traded for a guy like Adam Eaton, who's been a bit unheralded and kind of underrated here in his the last couple years of his career. The Nationals feel really good about this deal. They really like the player that Eaton is and has been over the last couple years, been really consistent. His on-base percentages in 2014 was .362. 361 in 2015 and 362 last year. So you kind of know exactly what you're getting from this guy. He's been a good defensive center field, defensive outfielder in 2 to 3 years. They like the fact that he's controlled for the next 5 years at an under, value contract. And I think when you put all those things together, it makes Eaton as just kind of a total, not to demean him as a person necessarily, I don't like using the word asset, but when you just think of him as an asset, and talk about the type of player he is, the contract, and the money and everything just kind of combined. That's why they felt comfortable giving up as much as they did for him. And it certainly is a lot, but like you said, it fills a need. You know, it gives them a center fielder for this year and possibly a corner outfielder for next year when Jason Worth is gone, if they don't think Eaton can definitely play center field long term. But they feel comfortable as far as putting Eaton out there in center field and think that he can be a good defensive center fielder. So, as the shock has kind of worn off a little bit, and like you said, it is a heavy price to pay, but they feel like they're getting a lot in return and what a guy they're going to have for the next potentially five seasons here in D.C.
And the price, of course, Lucas Giolito, former number one pitching prospect in baseball, Reynaldo Lopez, a guy who pitched well at the major league level a little bit late last year, and also Dane Dunning, who a lot of people really like, a guy that was just in a tough situation at Florida because they have so many good pitchers on that right. staff with the Gators. But as far as Giolito goes, did the team's opinion of Giolito over the last year change a little bit? Were they a little down on Giolito from where they were a year ago after what he did in 2016?
Yeah, I think the trade definitely signifies that. About a year ago, Giolito would have been the untouchable prospect. You kind of heard the rumblings about whether or not Trey Turner was actually movable or not, and he was kind of the guy deemed pretty much untouchable. And Giolito would have been that guy a year ago. He was number one prospect in baseball, and all during spring training, and even through the first half of the season, all I heard about is how the Nats felt like they had a guy, similar to the Mets when they introduced their, Noah Syndergaard and obviously Matt Harvey and Steven Matz and their kind of line of pitchers. Nats felt like one of the reasons they were so confident going into last season because they felt at some point they were going to be able to unveil a pitcher kind of on that level as well to kind of rejuvenate the rotation. And this guy was a future number one and really was not very impressive in his debut during the second half of last season. Only made about 5 or 6 starts, but he did struggle. And really the things that were concerning were things like his velocity was down. And he really just kind of didn't seem like he had more than maybe a one pitch a lot of times, too. It kind of was very fastball reliant, and that fastball wasn't being thrown as in the high 90s or so. It was kind of topping out at about 94. So, again, I think it's too early to tell whether or not Giolito won't be able to develop into a legit major league number one or top of the rotation starter. But I think definitely there were some doubts. And, as far as capitalizing on his ceiling necessarily, this was the time to do it, his value, because if he goes out and struggles again for another year, then potentially you kind of wonder what exactly would his trade value be and would, how would people necessarily perceive him. So right now he's still seen as one of the top pitching prospects and the top prospect in the game. They capitalized on that and put him together in a package, like you said, with Lopez, who was pretty successful last year, mostly in a relief role. And potentially could profile as a reliever as well. Like you said, they like a lot of things about Dunning, but just drafted him last season. He hasn't pitched above A-ball, so he's a guy who still might be ways away from the majors, so they kind of could afford to take that gamble right now. But like you said, this is a very clear signal that the confidence in Giolito isn't where it was maybe a year ago.
And it's a great point that if he does struggle again, suddenly the value plummets. So you get rid of him now where that value is still very high. Mentioned Trey Turner moving to shortstop. Danny Espinosa traded to the Angels. It's a situation where the Nationals didn't get a ton in return as far as this deal goes. Kyle McGowan, Austin Adams. McGowan was ranked 20th in the Angels system. I don't think he's ranked now in the National system. The Angels system has kind of on rough times here in the last few years. But they get something for Espinosa, which is better than if they had non-tendered him. And obviously, you don't have to pay him now for the season. So I guess this is what they could have hoped. They got the deal done. They had Espinosa in case they needed him. And now that they don't need him, they were able to get something for him.
And that's pretty much kind of what you're looking at here. It kind of clears the way, so there's no question marks or no just kind of – there was some reports about Espinosa potentially being unhappy with his role, if he's going to be asked to come off the bench or be a utility player or whatever. So you just kind of – you clear that, any bad juju out of the clubhouse with that, and whether or not who should be the starting shortstop, there's no kind of questions with that. And you kind of make a way for Trey Turner to have this spot as shortstop. Obviously he made the adjustment to move out to center field last year, played well, but it's a natural shortstop. He wants to be a shortstop, excited about the opportunity to return as shortstop. And they think that there's going to probably be some growing pains here, especially, there were some questions about him going into last season about just playing that position every day. So there's some things they're going to have to work through in the middle of the infield. Espinosa defensively, they're definitely going to miss him. But, when you look at the year Trey Turner put up last year and just how productive he was offensively, they're willing to kind of live with some of that and help him grow and let him learn on the fly a little bit at the position because he was so good offensively. And like I said, this deal, you do get something for Espinosa, and you can see what these guys essentially turn into, these two Angels pitchers. But, this is more about kind of paving the way and leaving this position open for Trey Turner and having him, especially too when you talk about a guy who's a middle infielder or a utility infielder off the bench. They would have paid Espinosa probably somewhere around $5 million in arbitration this year, and you can definitely get a utility infielder younger and cheaper than that. So they've got some guys on their roster who could replace him. Wilmer Defoe is definitely kind of the number one option there. Potentially Stephen Drew too. If they can find a way to re-sign him, probably come a little cheaper. So they've got other bench options, other things they can do as opposed to kind of paying Espinosa that sum to not play every day.
There were some reports that the Nats actually tried to get David Robertson involved in that trade as well with the White Sox along with Eaton, and which makes a lot of sense because the big goal was to get a closer as well at the winter meetings. They obviously were close on Mark Melanson, didn't get that done. So where do they turn now? They still need somebody there in the ninth inning. I mean, there's guys you could take a shot on, Greg Holland coming off Tommy John surgery. But the big three are all taken as far as free agency goes. Are the Nationals willing to maybe work a trade with a different team other than the White Sox as well? You hear Alex Colome out there, maybe a possibility of the Rays. There are guys out there, but it seems like now it's going to be a lot trickier than it was.
Yeah, and that's kind of the situation that they're in now. They've checked in on pretty much every available free agent reliever or closer closer in a trade market necessarily because they're trying to figure out exactly what the best way. Once they struck out on Melanson and made an offer that was reported for more money for Kenley Jansen as well. So, right now you're trying to figure out exactly what the exact right deal is. I'm under the belief that if they had the right match with the White Sox as far as Robertson, because they had so many discussions with the Sox about Chris Sale, then it discussions about Adam Eaton, that if there was a match for Robertson, that deal probably would have already been done at this point. So the fact that it hasn't kind of makes me think that maybe the White Sox asking price is too high or the Nats are comfortable giving up, whatever it might be. I just don't know. If they've had these discussions already, why all of a sudden now in a week or so that they decide, okay, we can now figure out something for Dave Robertson. But he's definitely still on their radar. They're interested in him. Alex Colome, as you mentioned, they have not really checked in much on Greg Holland just yet, but I think they were kind of in the Jansen mix, and that's kind of move that they could potentially pivot that way. But they also have some in-house some candidates as well. And, you know, it's something that they don't want to start the year with an unexperienced closer. And, you know, it's just a year right now that they feel like they can win now, and they're kind of all in, but they don't want to necessarily be gambling in the ninth inning. But, you know, you're kind of at a point where potentially they just kind of beef up some of their setup men and some of the guys in the seventh or eighth innings, and then, you know, move somebody unproven into the ninth inning, potentially Sean Kelly, Blake Treinen. They really like Kota Glover and have said numerous times that he's a future closer. So they're going to take a look at pretty much all the options here in the next month or so to see exactly what the best scenario and what the best kind of case is for it. There's not probably a clear favorite at this point. I think they would, like you said, would like to get somebody in that has experience, but if they can't find it or can't find a guy at the right price, I think they're comfortable with what they have in-house to start with this at least. Then potentially during the trade deadline or so, they can kind of acquire somebody else.
This has been MLB.com Extras, our Nationals edition. For Jamal Collier, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Mets reporter, Anthony DiComo. And, Anthony, things continue to be kind of quiet around the New York Mets. Obviously, the big signing of Yoenis Cespedes before the winter meetings even got started kind of took some air out of the balloon as far as what could go on at the winter meetings. But Jay Bruce is still a New York Mets, so that's something we're going to continue to kind of focus on, I guess, until it's no longer the case. When you look at Bruce, though, let's take it from this angle. There is a ton of outfielders available as far as free agency or trade. Some of them have now come off the board. Dexter Fowler has been signed, but so many guys are still there. Does that just kind of slow the process as far as the Mets go? Because all the teams they're dealing with have all these other things to consider.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, say you're the Orioles, for example. You've got a lot of inventory out there to take a look at, and Jay Bruce is certainly one of the pieces that you would consider if you're a team like that wants an outfielder. But there's also, you know, so many of these other guys, and the dominoes are starting to fall. You're seeing the Dexter Fowlers of the world sign. You're seeing a couple of trades here and there. But I think teams are still kind of in that process where they're looking at everything that's out there. They're looking at all their possibilities, and they're trying to figure out what makes the best sense for them. If there's a place where the Mets erred, and we won't really know until after this is all said and done, I think they did underestimate maybe a little bit just how much outfield inventory was out there, how many different names are out there that teams could go after. But that doesn't mean the Mets won't be able to trade Jay Bruce. I still think they will. I still think they'll get a decent deal for him because, again, as we've talked about, this is a 29-year-old outfielder with a track record of hitting 30 home runs or close to it just about every year, and that's a big deal. So I do think the Mets will be able to get something done. Sandy Alderson has kind of intimated, hey, if we wanted to get something done yesterday, we could have, but the Mets are sitting back. They're waiting for the right deals. And if you look at Sandy Alderson's track record, even in situations such as these, where, you know, he has a player on the block and the whole league knows he's on the block and everyone knows that the Mets do not want to go into 2017 with Jay Bruce on their roster, Sandy Alderson has a pretty decent track record of getting these things done. You go back to his first big deal, the Carlos Beltran trade back in 2012, and for a similar situation, a guy who had to go, the Mets wind up getting Zach Wheeler for him, which was a huge haul. And not that this is quite the same caliber of trade, but you know, as far as trades go in general, Sandy's tenure with the Mets, he's done pretty well.
If you had to take a guess as far as time frame goes, are we thinking in the next couple of weeks before the new year, or is this something that could drag into January?
I would be surprised if it drags into January. I think the Mets very much want to get something done before the holidays. I think they will. I think, like I said, you're starting to see some of these outfield dominoes fall. You're seeing most of the big names fall. And I think if you had to rank everyone who's left, who's out there on the market, whether it's free agency or trades, Jay Bruce is pretty close to the top of the list. So I do think you're going to see something happen in the next couple of weeks here. And the only thing that would prevent it is if the Mets just still aren't getting an offer that they find acceptable. They're not going to get something done before the holidays just for the sake of getting something done before the holidays. They will let it drag into January if they feel that's where the market takes them. But I would be surprised at this point. I was a little surprised they didn't get more traction at the winter meetings. I would be very surprised if they don't get a lot of traction on a Jay Bruce trade before Christmas.
Sandy Alderson said that they're not going to add pieces more than likely until after Bruce is dealt because they don't want to be stuck with, in theory, both. You sign some bullpen help, and then you can't trade Bruce, and then you're on the hook for all of it. That makes sense, but that also puts I guess, a little more pressure on getting a deal done, because you don't want all those possible bullpen arms that they could add, that you don't want that market to wash up.
Yeah, I think a bigger part of that is that market, the specific relief pitcher market that the Mets are looking at, which is kind of those sixth, seventh inning guys on one-year deals. So you're getting maybe an older pitcher. You're getting maybe someone who is coming off injury, someone who for whatever reason would not command a two- or three-year deal. That market tends to develop in January anyway. So I do think that's a bigger part of it than just the payroll aspect. But look, the payroll is important. The Mets have said, Sandy Ellison has said, that while as we sit here today recording this podcast, the Mets are at about $150 million, they want to be under that when the season starts. And once they trade Jay Bruce, do they have to take on some salary in that trade or eat some of Jay Bruce's salary? Well, however the deal might shake out, it's going to color their budget for the rest of the winter. They don't know right now exactly how much they have to spend on the bullpen. It's not going to be a ton either way, but once they get that Jay Bruce deal finally squared away, assuming it is Bruce who goes and assuming they can get it done, it will make their budget much clearer, and it will give the Mets a much better sense of just how much they have to spend, just who they can go out and target aggressively in the relief market.
So anyone who thinks they're going to trade Bruce and then take that $13 million and spend it elsewhere, that's not going to happen.
They'll spend some of it. Yeah. They will not spend all of it. I think Sandy Ellison has made that clear. You're probably looking at a payroll that's, you know, just a smidge north of $140 million going into next year, which would give them a wiggle room of a few million, maybe $3 to $5, $6 million to spend on relievers, and they could spread that out over one guy or two or three guys. But no, the idea that the Mets will trade Jay Bruce, will shed that $13 million worth of salary, and then plug it all right back into the bullpen, I think is not something the team is looking at doing right now. And another thing, you know, we talk about payroll so often with this team. The Mets look at payroll through a wider scope. They look at it for the balance of the entire team, and they look at what their budget is for 2017 and say, we're not going to spend it all in December 2016, January 2017. We want to save part of that so that we have, if we're in it, the ability to take on salary at the trade deadline. They've done it in years past. They did it last year with Jay Bruce. They did it the year before with Yoan Cespedes. And it's a flexibility that they like having going into the season. So that is part of the reason why, when they're setting their budget now here going into the year, they'd like to keep a little bit in reserve so that they can go out and make a move if they need it.
Juan Lagares, some bad news on him. Injured playing in the Dominican Winter League, and I guess he's made the trip here to New York to have the doctors check it out. It's a shoulder issue, which shoulders are never good. I don't think it's considered serious, Anthony, but it's just kind of Juan Lagares is hurt again, right?
Exactly. There's not a sense in the Mets today that it is a serious injury. It should be fine. He should be fine for opening day, but you hit the nail on the head there. This is a guy who, you know, has been a somewhat important part of the team for a while now, could have been a much more important part of the team. And frankly, a large part of that is because he hasn't been able to stay healthy. He had that hyperextension of his right elbow a couple of years back that wound up really, really hurting his throwing. And such a good throwing arm when he won the Gold Glove. I mean, that was his game, and went essentially a year without being able to throw at all. He's had other scrapes and bruises. Last year, he missed that time with the lacerated thumb tendon that he tried to play through, and that didn't work out. So a lot of issues for Juan Lagares for a relatively young guy, and if he can ever stay on the field and remain on the field, he still has a prominent role with this team. Signed that long-term contract extension a few years ago, still has a couple years left on that, and while he's not the everyday, even borderline star outfielder that the Mets hoped he could develop into, he's a useful piece. He still plays Gold Glove defense. He can still hit lefties at a pretty decent clip, and he's still a very valuable guy off the bench coming in late in games, spelling a Curtis Granderson or a Michael Conforto defensively. So the Mets need him to be healthy. They need him to stay healthy, and the fact that he can't get through a winter ball season healthy, I think, is certainly a little bit of a concern.
And you mentioned spelling Curtis Granderson, and that's really very important for this team. I mean, you know, Curtis Granderson is probably already going to be playing center field maybe more than ideally, but to have him have to play that much more if you don't have Juan Lagares to step in against different pitchers, that makes it even that much worse, and that makes your defense that much worse in front of behind a great pitching staff.
Yeah, absolutely. And Curtis Granderson has admitted, you know, he said recently, when I took over center field for Yoan Cespedes late last season, I wasn't sure how my body would react to it, how I'd able to handle it. And it wound up being better than he thought, certainly better than the Mets thought he could handle it. But he's going to be 36 now. He's going into a season in which you're probably looking at Curtis Granderson starting 80, 90 games in center field. That's a lot for a 36-year-old, even one in as good of shape as Granderson, even one with as much center field experience as Granderson. So those little, you know, Juan Legarth comes in the seventh inning, subs in with a big lead or even a close game and you know, takes two innings, takes Curtis Granderson off his feet for two innings here two or three times a week. That adds up. It adds up for a 36-year-old. I think it's an important part, like you said. And, you know, Juan Legarth being healthy, we really haven't seen it yet, and it would be a very nice piece for the Mets to have if we see it in 2017.
Hopefully the injury is very minor and he'll be ready to go soon enough. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Mets edition. For Anthony DiComo, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Marlins reporter, Joe Fusaro. And, Joe, the winter meetings are in the rearview mirror. Teams heading back to their regular markets. And the Marlins went into National Harbor, Maryland, trying to snag one of the big three closers on the market. And it's starting to look more and more unlikely that that's going to happen. Reports coming out as we record this on Monday afternoon that the Dodgers close to agreeing on a deal with Kenley Jansen. How big a blow will it be for the Marlins? Kenley Jansen heads to the Dodgers after Aroldis Chapman headed back to the Yankees and Mark Melancon headed to the Giants.
Well, Tim, I guess it's a big blow when you make a priority to land, you know, a front line or, you know, among the best in the game type of closer than if you, you know, swing and miss on all three of your targets. But I will say this regarding Jansen, if this deal had been signed with the Marlins, it was going to be one of the tougher internal, you know, signings they've made in a long time because there was a real split in the organization as to do this. And just like sentiment from the industry, you know, along with the high price tag for Kenley would come the originally the 14th, but now the 13th pick in the draft. And for a system that could use more assets to depart with that was going to be, you know, really painful. So this, you know, there was a lot of divide in the room about whether to pursue this. Now, that said, anytime you could add, you know, one of the top players at their position, you know, you make your team stronger for the immediate. And, you know, the Marlins, I think, have been prepared to go either way. And, you know, the money that they could have allocated for Kenley could now be spread over, you know, their fallback plan, which was to get probably another two, maybe even three relievers. You know, one of them actually just came on the board with the announcement during the meetings that they're going to get Dustin McGowan back in more of a long relief role. Dustin has been with the club in 16. So, you know, now the attention will turn to the Brad Zieglers, to the Tazawa, if I'm pronouncing it right, yep, from Boston, and just kind of look at, you know, Natale Feliz and, you know, that, you know, you kind of come off, you know, look into that list because the Marlins, you know, thinking going in was the strength of this free agent market is bullpen, you know, so obviously everyone knows the need for more starting pitching, but if that pitching's not there, you know, it's almost like the approach of a draft. Do you go with the strength of a draft or kind of force another need? So I think you're going to see them be aggressive pursuing, you know, the guys I just noted, whether it's, you know, Daniel Hudson. It doesn't have to be a true closer, but I think they want, because, you know, they're perfectly confident with A.J. Ramos back there, but I think they would like someone with closing experience because roles can kind of shift over the course of the year. And if, you know, AJ needs a rest, you know, it's good to have somebody that's experienced step right in.
You won't be able to say that the Marlins didn't try to get one of those big closers, that's for sure. There was reports, Joe, that they actually offered Chapman more than the Yankees did, and he was just happier to go back to a place he's familiar with, obviously, with New York. Jansen, obviously, the money probably wouldn't have been as big because of that draft pick, but you make up a good point. Maybe this is one of those deals in the long run when you look back at it that it's better to not have done a deal for Kenley Jansen because, hey, that's a high draft pick. That's one of the higher draft picks you'd be able to lose, really, in this scenario. So picking 13th is important. We'll certainly see how it rounds out. As far as A.J. Ramos goes, how confident are the Marlins that he'll be the same guy he was early on in 2016 when he really put together an all-star first half?
Well, if people kind of just study A.J. Ramos and who he is and you know, kind of his background and his determination and his competitiveness, this guy may go down as one of the best relievers in Marlins history. You know, I'm not just going to say closer because they kind of closers kind of come and go quickly with the Marlins, but just in terms of durability, in terms of production, a guy who not a lot of people know about, a guy who, when he's effective, has four pitches working for him. Now, what I think one of the reasons why you might have seen him go for a Chance or a Chapman is A.J. kind of gets in a mess and then has a way of getting out of it. He's not the most overpowering closer. He's not bringing 97 to 100, you know, and I think that – and he walks hitters too because he will not give in to them and he will use his mix to try to get out of it. And if it's a walk, sometimes that's what happens. So I think, you know, if you're looking for what do you feel the most confident with, sure, you're like – for all this Chapman going 100, 200, 30 miles an hour, you know, even if he misses down the middle, the chances of being hit really hard aren't always that high. But, you know, A.J. is a really confident guy, and his drop-off in the second half of the year would be a concern. But he was dealing with a finger that was slightly fractured, third finger and at the knuckle, and it was having a hard time, you know, manipulating the baseball the way he wanted to, and he was just kind of gutting it out. So, you know, when you say how confident are they can duplicate, first, you know, I'm always one of those guys who, when I evaluate players from year to year, I foremost measure health. And if you are healthy, then you're saying, yeah, chances of production are going to be high. When you're coming back from an injury, this isn't an arm injury, it's not a shoulder, it's not an elbow. This is a, you know, a swollen finger that should be down and he should be fine. So he's 29, just turned 30 years old, I believe. So, you know, still, you know, pretty young, and a guy that, you know, has kind of come into his own. So, you know, he was an all-star in 2016. So, you know, they certainly have a very good closing fallback. But like I said, if Brad Ziegler could come on board, then you got a guy who offers a different look. And you know, we just kind of maybe swing the topic a little bit, but I think that's what they're looking for, just different looks at their bullpen. You know, they'll have, you know, guys that, you know, a guy like a Ziegler who throws from the side would be a different type of look. And, you know, so they're trying to get as number of guys that give hitters, you know, as much confusion as possible.
How much of a factor also is, beyond the money and the fact that you're going to run up that payroll signing a guy like Jansen, there's also the years, Joe, and he would get 5 years, I don't know, maybe 6 years, whereas a Ziegler, a Tozawa, all these other guys, you're probably looking at just a couple of years, which really opens things up down the road as far as spending that money. If you don't necessarily spend it now, it's that much more available down the road.
Yeah, Tim, very good point. I think that's where if you would have done, you know, kind of the, you know, I think what you look at in free agency, we all kind of get wrapped up in it is excitement and emotion. And that's what the human element, that's what kind of moves us as a fan. But then there's the practicality of it. And I think the effective teams are the ones that make the smartest choices. And sometimes those aren't the most seemingly attractive or big splash moves. So I think you had a good number of people in the Marlins camp saying, look, all along, let's go measured. You know, look what they did with the rotation. Edinson Volquez, 2 years, $22 million. That's not really going to, you know, cripple them as they move forward. If that signing doesn't work, and you're completely right. If you could get, you know, pitchers, relievers with track records on 1 to 2 year plans in the $5 million range, and you load up on those guys, in the meantime, trying to, you know, retain your young assets and get that 13th pick and hopefully make a good pick if you're the Marlins, that is probably the sensible way to grow it. But when you're looking at this team with this window in 17, with the All-Star game coming, with trying to sell as many tickets and keep as much competitiveness in the division, you know, that's where the Jansens, the Chapmans become attractive, even if it doesn't, you know, appear logical to people outside this market and for what they're trying to establish. But I think they were kind of in a situation where, you're right, if you go 80, 82, 83 million on Jansen and also you're parting with your first-round pick, And, you know, keep in mind, they're always that one comeback line drive or that one pitch away from a bad, you know, something bad happening to them. And then what, you know, down the road? And we're kind of looking at 18. You know, as you look at 17, I think Stanton, Giancarlo goes to $14.5 million. And then come 18, he goes to $25 million, and it keeps going up from there. So, you know, if you're looking at a closer making 18 to 20 million in 18 or 19, you know, you're putting yourself in a payroll bind that you may not be able to get out of for a while.
Great stuff as always, Joe. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Marlins edition. For Joe Fusaro, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Braves reporter Mark Bowman. Mark, winter meetings are over, pretty quiet for the Braves, which isn't a surprise when you look at where this team's at. They're not the type of team that's going to make a big splash at the winter meetings. But what is left to do for this Atlanta team between now and the kickoff of spring training?
Well, you know, during the winter meetings, they did at least have discussions for some starting pitchers. You know, they at least asked about Sale, obviously, when the White Sox asked for Dansby Swanson. That's where the conversation ended, and kind of rightfully so. The White Sox needed Dansby in the deal, and the Braves weren't willing to give him up. So they've at least maintained some interest in Jose Quintana as well. But at the same time, you know, that price is probably going to be a little bit too steep for them. You know, the amount, the depth that they would have to dip into their prospect pool. So I do expect them probably to stay put. But at the same time, I'm not going to be surprised to hear that they're at least still asking around about top line starting pitchers at the same. Now on the catching front, you know, you've got Tyler Flowers and Anthony Rekker set to handle those duties. They would like to get a better option than Rekker to serve as Tyler's backup, or at least another guy to share the time with Tyler. Jason Castro would have been the perfect guy as a left-handed bat. Obviously his price was too high. Wellington Castillo is available, but his price is going to be too high. I do expect, you know, if you ask me right now, you know, how are they going to start the season, it'll be Flowers and Rekker. But at the same time, once teams start to put their rosters together and get a feel for how everything's going to shape up with not only, you know, in terms of personnel, but also finances, there may be a guy that opens up a catcher they would be willing to trade for.
Team also making some minor moves over the last week. Tyrell Jenkins is a guy that we talked about a lot on this podcast over the last year, really, Mark, as far as is he going to end up being a starter? Will he end up being a reliever in the long run? Well, the Braves no longer have to make that decision because they've packaged him with Brady Feigl, and they get Luke Jackson in return, who it's an interesting piece. He's one of these guys that high upside possibility for a power pitcher, but maybe you're not sure the chances of him reaching that full potential.
Yeah, exactly. You know, basically what they did with a lot of these guys over the last couple of weeks with Tyrell Jenkins, Rob Whalen, John Gant, they basically were cleaning out a surplus of starting pitchers that they've already had a chance to get a good look at. And they said, look, you know, we've got Aaron Blair and Matt Whistler in place, that they're major league ready right now. Sean Newcomb, Max Fried, Patrick Weigel, these guys are on their way. You know, and so in other words, to keep these guys around, like Tyrell Jenkins, Gant, these guys who were fringe starters, maybe bullpen guys, it made sense for them to go out and get a guy like Jackson, a power arm who, you know, look, he's somewhat of a lottery ticket, too. You don't know what you're going to get, but at the same time, it filled a little bit more of an area of need with greater upside. So, you know, basically this has been a weeding out process, maybe just a cleaning out process where, you know, they had a chance to look at Jenkins. And while he's a great guy, you know, it was fun to be around him. He interacted well with fans. At the end of the day, you don't know if he's going to be a starter, and he really doesn't have the stuff to profile as a reliever either. So it made sense to part ways with him just to take a chance on another guy who, like I said, he fit a greater area of need. Can't get enough power arms, especially when you see what the price of you know, top relievers is. You hope that one of these guys with, you know, like they did with Jose Ramirez and Mauricio Cabrera, all of a sudden they started throwing strikes this year.
if you get these guys with that kind of arm throwing strikes, all of a sudden you might find yourself with one of these top relievers where you're not having to pay the prices. And I'm not throwing these guys in the Chapman category, but you get what I'm saying. You're trying to get lucky with at least one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Ever the optimist, Mark. A couple of interesting minor league deals for this team recently. Emilio Bonifacio, a guy who's no stranger to the Braves organization. Decent year at AAA last year. Obviously, this is a guy who used to have a bigger role in the major leagues. He's still trying to kind of refine that. And then John Danks, similar situation. Here's a guy who used to be a 200-inning-a-year type pitcher. He's not all that old, but it's been a few years since he was effective on the mound. The Braves signed both guys. They'll be in spring training, and it's another situation where maybe you can catch lightning in the bottle one more time with these guys.
Yeah, in some ways, I think that the Bonifacio deal, I think maybe not as much as why did the Braves want to go after Bonifacio is as much as why did Bonifacio want to come back to the Braves when he signs the deal last year, gets released at the end of spring training, has that embarrassing episode there at Wrigley Field where he thinks he's been called up, but they find out that the rules prevent him from being on the active roster, and then all of a sudden he gets 43 total plate appearances with this team this past year. Now, could they use another versatile position players, yes. Could he fit that need? Maybe. But you look at what he's done the last couple of years at the big league level. 2 years ago, the White Sox basically gave up on him. Last year, like I said, he spent most of the season with Gwinnett. This guy just provides some depth, as does Danks. The Danks deal, I get it. That's why you still want to add some depth. You look at what you have. You basically have eight guys already coming to camp that could be, ready to fill your rotation right now with Teron, Fultonevich, Colon, Dickey, Garcia, Colmenter, Blair, Whistler. Now you throw Danks in that mix. You look at what he did last year. The most concerning thing is his velocity dipped down to about 87 miles per hour. So coming off a shoulder surgery, you look at what the numbers have been. I get why maybe you say we need to add a little bit more depth. I just don't know why you go and get this guy. But, maybe they will get lucky with him. At the same time, I think that he's just a guy that could fill some space during spring training, provide some insurance. Maybe Colemanter struggles during spring training, and you say Danks is a better option to use as a long reliever out of the bullpen to start the season. But at the same time, this guy has to prove he's healthy in the last few years that what he has shown has not provided much confidence in that area.
In a podcast filled with minor-type moves, Mark, we're going to end on one more. The Rule 5 draft is always the end of the winter meetings, comes up Thursday morning, and kind of a throwaway for a lot of people, but a lot of teams do make selections, as did the Braves this year. They released Williams Perez to kind of clear room on the 40-man roster. And then in the Rule 5 draft, they select Armando Rivero, who's kind of another one of those intriguing arms. He comes from the Cubs, and his numbers in 2016, granted, not major league numbers by any stretch, but 105 strikeouts and 67 and two-thirds innings and an ERA near 2. I mean, those numbers jump off the page at you, but what's the upside for Armando Rivero?
I think that was, while I might question the Bonifacio and Danks signing, the decision to, open up a 40-man spot with a guy that probably wasn't going to factor into the rotation this year, Williams Perez, to get this power arm from the Cubs system, who was, John Coppola said it, look, Cubs are the best team in baseball. If you're going to go and try to find depth somewhere, that's the best place to find it, unprotected depth. And, I think this guy, especially if they start with an 8-man bullpen, could begin this season at the big league. Well, let's put it this way, as a Rule 5 guy, he has to. I think that they could they'll choose to keep him as long as he throws strikes throughout spring training. I think that, as you noted, the number that stood out is how much he improved his strikeout ratio from 15 to 16. Those are numbers that jump off the table. He was a guy that came over from Cuba. He's only been in the professional ranks for a few years now, so something may have clicked last year, and the Braves may benefit.
Great stuff as always, Mark. Thanks a lot. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Braves edition. For Mark Bowman, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Phillies reporter Todd Zalecki. The winter meetings are behind us. As expected, Todd, pretty quiet as far as the Phillies go as they still continue the rebuild. And I think that's an interesting spot to start on. We'll get to some other stuff, some spring training invites and a look back at Mickey Moniak's first year as a Philly. But I want to start there because this is a team that has money to spend when the time is right. And I think maybe there could have been some temptation here to start it, to make that big splash. But the Phillies were able to stand pat, stick to their plan is the way to say it. But it's not going to be too long now before they start breaking open the wallet.
No, not at all. In fact, I think it's going to start next offseason. I think you're going to start seeing them spend some serious money. This is a question I get more than any other question, which is why aren't they – kind of making a bigger splash right now, and the answer basically is they want to use this season to really figure out, and it's kind of a sink or swim season for a lot of these young players and a lot of these young prospects. You know, is Roman Quinn a guy that they can count on in the future? Dylan Cousins, Nick Williams, Aaron Altair, Tommy Joseph at first base, you know, can Michael Franco figure out some things? Freddie Galvis and Cesar Hernandez up the middle in the infield, you know, Cameron Rupp, Andrew Knapp behind the plate. The list goes on and on and on. And I think what they want to do is they want to finish next season with a much clearer picture of who can play and who can't, and then be a little bit smarter in how they spend their money. You know, a lot of people have asked me, you know, why didn't they go out and sign Ian Desmond this offseason? He would have definitely helped this lineup, and which is true. But if they had spent $70 million on Ian Desmond, it would have done a couple things. One, they would have given you $70 million less to go out and get another big free agent next offseason, Bryce Harper, Manny Machado 2 years from now. And also would have decreased the opportunities for those guys to play like Roman Quinn, Eric Altair, Dylan Cousins, Nick Williams. So I think basically, like I said, they want to use next season to learn about as much of these players, and not just position players too, the starting rotation, the bullpen, and then next offseason they're going to well, we know these three starters, I see them a part of the future, but we need to go out and get an ace. Okay, now they can go out and get an ace. But, you know, or say Roman Quinn and Dylan Cousins come up next year and they look like superstars in the making. Now maybe you don't spend the money on Bryce Harper in a couple of years, but maybe you spend the money on, say, Clayton Kershaw opts out of his contract, or Johnny Cueto opts out of his contract, or Manny Machado is available. You know, it gives you some options, you know, in terms of how to spend your money and spend your money smarter. So going forward, they fill all the holes that they need to fill so they can get back to the playoffs and have a sustained run in the playoffs.
Yeah, and you make a good point that when you just look at this free agent class as opposed to the next two, there's a lot more coming up, not just next year, but then the big free agent class that you mentioned in 2018 with Bryce Harper and Manny Machado and so many guys available that year, including maybe even Clayton Kershaw if he opts out of his deal. But, yeah, great stuff, and props to the Phillies for sticking to the plan, because it's going to be hard in a market like Philadelphia where, you know, I think the fans have kind of – they understand what's going on, and they're on board to as much a degree as you can when your team's rebuilding. But there's still a lot of pressure in Philadelphia to get a winner there as quick as possible. All right, another thing I wanted to touch on, Paul Hagan has a story on Phillies.com right now, Todd, about the team's kind of continued movement towards analytics. They were, I mean, let's be honest, one of the last teams to kind of jump into this, but with the new regime, they're very much involved. And it's not just the typical analytics that a lot of teams are doing, but they're kind of taking it the extra step now. There was a study, I guess, that some of their minor leaguers have been involved in with an organization, WHOOP, W-H-O-O-P, and it goes beyond the normal analytics, and it gets into sleep patterns and eating right and everything else that can help a player really maximize performance.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. They're really kind of exploring any avenue they can in terms of improving performance. And so they got involved with this company, like you mentioned, to look at sleep patterns and things of that nature, biometrics to see if they can gain any sort of edge, to see if they can learn something. And I think that's kind of where sports is going and certainly baseball is going. You want to really know as much as you possibly can, whether that be, like you said, sleep patterns, injury prevention, diet, you know, anything that you can do to kind of get that little edge over another team. And really, even if it doesn't end up panning out, you at least have to learn to see if it works, or try to see if it works, to try to see if it helps. Because if you kind of dismiss it out of hand and go like, oh, this sounds ridiculous, then you don't learn it. Maybe it's a huge advantage for you. So I give the Phillies some props there for taking a look at these types of things. Whether or not it actually translates to wins on the field, you know, remains to be seen. But certainly interesting stuff, and definitely kind of complements the more traditional analytics research and development that they're now kind of getting more and more into at the Phillies.
On the podcast last week from the winter meetings, we talked a little bit about the mutual attraction, I guess, between the Phillies and A.J. Ellis to return as a backup catcher. That ends up not working out as Ellis ends up agreeing to a deal with the Marlins. So what does that do for the Phillies' backup catcher position? Are they happy to go with the prospect Alfaro as the backup, or is there still a look to find a veteran out there to come in before spring training?
You know, now that A.J. Ellis has signed with the Marlins, I think they're going to stick internally. And actually, what I think is going to happen is Alfaro, who is one of the top 100 prospects in baseball, they love him. He's got tremendous power. He's got one of the best arms behind the plate anywhere at any level. I think he actually might go back and start the season in AAA to kind of continue his development, because he spent all of last year in AA Redding. And what I think he might see happen is Andrew Knapp, Another top catching prospect, maybe not quite at the level of Alfaro. He spent all of last season in AAA, and I think he could be the backup to Cameron Rupp. And talking to Matt Klentak about it last week at the winter meetings, he really seemed to be okay with that. You know, at some point, in his mind, I think you have to let some of these young guys play. And again, we talked about it more in an everyday role with players like Roman Quinn and Tommy Joseph, et cetera. But even in a backup role like Andrew Knapp, you have to see if he can play or not and see if he's going to be part of your future, either as a backup catcher. Maybe he can pass up Cameron Rupp as an everyday player. You never know. But I think that's the way they're going to go now. Alfaro, to me, was just a little bit too raw. He had still too much room to grow. And I guess in a sense, it's a compliment to him that he probably doesn't see it this way, but it's kind of a compliment to him and how they view him that they might start him in AAA as the everyday catcher, because they want him playing every single day and continuing to develop, because I don't think they look at him as a backup. And not to say that Andrew Knapp can't be more than a backup, but they're looking at him to be solid player in the future.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You look ahead to spring training, Todd, and some invites have gone out from the Phillies, and some interesting names, guys like Sean Burnett and Daniel Nava, guys who have had success in the past. Their careers in recent years haven't been what they once were, I guess, or what they had flashes of, but still some interesting names and some fun storylines, I guess, for you come February when you head down to Clearwater.
Yeah, I think both of those guys have a chance at making the team. You know, Burnett is a lefty out of the bullpen, and Nava is an extra bench bat, extra outfielder. And those things are always intriguing. You know, it's always kind of fun to watch. See, you know, Burnett's coming back from, he's only pitched like 15 innings the last 3 years because of double Tommy John surgery. So, you know, can he come back and actually be a productive pitcher again? So those are the battles that do kind of make spring training a little bit more interesting, kind of these comeback stories and just, you know, guys trying to, you know, reestablish himself in the big leagues. Not to say that they're going to be big players or real key contributors, but, gives you something a little bit more to look for, a little bit more depth to the Phillies, certainly. And, so those competitions should be fun to watch.
One more thing to touch on with you, Todd. At the winter meetings, Mickey Moniak, of course, the number one draft pick in the draft last June of the Phillies, he accepted his Baseball America High School Player of the Year award, which kind of, I guess, puts a bow on that portion of his playing career. But when you look at what he did in obviously a brief time and not a full season with the Phillies, his first year in the organization, did he get off to the start that the Phillies were hoping for? I know the numbers are pretty good, and I, to this point, I've heard nothing but good things about him. Is he right where the Phillies want him to be as still an 18, 19-year-old?
Yeah, I think so. They're very happy with how he played in the Gulf Coast League. He hit about 280, or, you know, 340, 350 on base percentage, showed a lot of talent at the plate, showed a lot of talent in the field. And you know, they could not be more pleased with what they saw from him. You know, certainly they're expecting big things from him down the road, which is why they took him number one overall. But nothing, absolutely nothing that he did this season in the Gulf Coast League has them feeling any differently about him.
Before Moniak, three previous players were able to win the BA High School Player of the Year award and go number one in the draft. This is pretty good company. Josh Hamilton, Justin Upton, and Joe Mauer. So if that's any sign, Phillies have plenty of reasons to be excited about Mickey Moniak. Great stuff as always, Todd. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Phillies edition. For Todd Zielecki, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
MLB.TV Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.TV Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go. Every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details.